Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, January 10th, 2019. A Sudanese diaspora member hopes people remember the personal stories behind the Sudanese protests. And ex-combatants in Yambio have laid down their guns and are now working to reintegrate into society. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A senior program assistant with the U.S. Institute of Peace for Sudan and South Sudan programs says the protests in Sudan these past few weeks will continue as long as President Omar al-Bashir refuses to step down. Mohiddin Omer says the people are demanding change and won't stop until they get it.
And the main reason why people began protesting is they're demanding that the government to change its policies and the government to completely not only change its policies but also consider changing the president himself. So as long as the government is not able to address some of the challenges that are associated with the economic collapse, then people will continue to protest.
Well, you know that in his remarks he said something to the effect of I'm going to make these changes and, you know, people are going to get paid and, you know, the economic crisis is going to dissipate. Can you believe him?
Of course not. The government is not able to carry on the changes that they have promised because look at Sudan today. It's a structural economic problem that cannot be solved by just firing one cabinet member or bringing in a new cabinet member. This is a structural, political, and economic problem that the country is facing. So the best way for them to address this issue, I think, is for the president to step down.
Part of that problem, too, is when South Sudan broke away, and they have the oil reserves, right?
Definitely, yeah. That's one of their main sources of income, and they lost that. The government lost the opportunity to diversify its economy, and now it's too late to try to do that. And it's almost impossible to do that under the current government. So I don't think there will be tangible changes in the next few months or next year because the same people who caused the problem are still in charge of the country. The protesters are demanding that the government completely changes its behavior and the president just goes. And I think that's the best way to address the problem.
Bashir told the crowd he will not resign, saying those seeking power need to do so through free and fair elections. What's your response to that?
Well, as if he came to power in a free and fair election, this is the guy who came to power through a military coup. He doesn't know anything about free and fair election to begin with. And secondly, I don't think people have patience to wait until free election, as he would call it, in 2020. Those problems need to be addressed right now, immediately. And can the government does that? I don't know. The government can't. I don't know if they can do that.
How are these protests different from the ones that we have seen before in their protests against Bashir's rule, which has been going on for 29 years now, including the government attacks against the people of Darfur, Blue Nile State, Nuba Mountains? We've seen these kinds of protests before in the streets of Sudan, in Khartoum, and somehow he's been able to stay in control. Why is it different now?
Oh, definitely. One thing I would point out to is that this time the protests are across Sudan. It's not just isolated one city or one town. It's across Sudan. About 2 days ago, there was a huge protest. They call it a million people participation protest in Al-Gadarif. In that protest, millions actually people participated in that protest, according to some reports. And the next day, there was protest in Khartoum, in upper north part of the country, in the center, in Darfur, in all parts of the Sudan. We haven't seen that in Sudan for the last few years. So the difference is that the energy, the participation is day after day increasing. So that's one difference. The second is that people are able to communicate actively between participants in different states using social media platforms and other communication platforms. So we see that today happening across the country, and not only young people from universities participating, also elder people participating, young people, kids are participating in this
protest. And that's different from previous protests?
Definitely, definitely. It's different.
The thing is, it's a fact that he was indicted on war crimes and crimes against humanity years ago, and he's even traveled outside of Sudan, gone to these other countries. Nobody has arrested him. He seems to be the Teflon man. Do you think he's really going to, this is going to be his come down this time?
I definitely believe so, because the condition is just different than what we have seen in the past. Right now, what you see is that you see a greater participation in the protests, number one. And number two, the political dynamic in the region has shifted in the last few years. Also, the ability of the president to influence events in the region has completely shifted, because as you mentioned earlier, he has lost his main source of income, which is the oil.
That is Mohideen Omer, a senior program assistant with the U.S. Institute of Peace on Sudan and South Sudan. He was speaking to me in our VOA studios here in Washington this past hour. Tomorrow, Mohideen Omer talks about implementing South Sudan's revitalized peace deal and the political future of the country. A Sudanese diaspora member hopes people will go beyond the news and think about the personal stories and challenges that each Sudanese protester feels. Manal Taha, a Sudanese-born American scholar and former Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, says the violence reported in Sudan's protests are taking a personal toll on many.
I feel like I should be there. I should do something to help them. And all I can do, I just speak out. I spread the word that's what's happening in Sudan has to stop. For 30 years, almost 29, 30 years, approaching to 30 years, three generations grew up in one government, in one regime. They revolt now not because they don't have bread. No, it's not. This is a trigger. It's way bigger than this. It's not only just bread. Sudanese revolt for dignity. It's thawrat al-karama. The dignity revolution is being against this suppressions for long time. At the same time, the young people, Sudanese, they have majority now are youth, and they didn't have any chance to be involved in any decision making.
And this isn't the first time that the Sudanese have taken to the streets to demand change, but this time it feels different.
Yeah, it's different. Yes, Sudanese, they revolt, but now they revolt from different areas, from the states, from privileged, and the margins and the regions. The first revolution was actually happening in Atbara, my hometown, and it's continued small neighborhoods in villages. I saw one of the video clip from my village. I grew up and I studied. It's called Khilewa. It's way back on the margins of the states and the country. People came out. They came and they built up slow by slow. And now you have it in Omdurman and in Khartoum.
What role do you think the international community plays in this, including the ICC?
The ICC has a huge impact on this regime in terms of his. The ICC is a threat for the President Omar al-Bashir and for many other people within him that have some atrocities and being called by international justice. That could be one of the factors that he wanted to stay. As long as he's in the power, he's immune. But also we have to not only just the survival for this regime is not only just because of the his fears from ICC. There's other elements involved on that. The regional dynamics. The support that Omar al-Bashir regime got from the Saudi Arabia recently, and they're involved in the Yemen war. There was a revolution happening from Sudanese people back in September, and many people died because of that. But what's happening, there was an aid injected in Khartoum government through some money coming from the Gulf countries, specifically Saudi Arabia, because exchange for soldiers fighting in Yemen. And more just recently, we have some soldiers, we hear that they are in Syria. So having this Khartoum government positioning themselves strategically on this in the regional dynamics, it plays a big role for the regime to continue, let alone their agreements with the European Union on the fighting smuggling through the Sudan as a cross-border, as a cross-route for the smuggling and trafficking and human smuggling and trafficking through Libya and to Europe. So all that's regional dynamics and international dynamics may affect and give this regime a longer time to stay. Still, the threat for ICC exists on Omar al-Bashir heads and his people who committed these atrocities in Darfur. But there's no way out. You know, there's no out. Like people now, the claim is like, is it justice over peace or peace over justice? That's a question Sudanese people themselves, they will answer it, and they will be able to do it, because I have a faith that people came out in the street. They may not know that what they want, how they're going to govern themselves, what the transitional structure is on the place, but still they want some change, and it's a legitimate and it's a right questions to ask now after 30 years. It's high time for things to shake and to change. And I see the international community has a big role to play, specifically here in the United States. There's a big role to play on supporting this and to supporting democracy, or at least just leave them alone. Don't interfere in a way that can actually inject any life for this Sudanese people. They will be able to take this, to change this regime themselves. When they came out in the street, they didn't ask anybody support. They came from themselves. So let them finish this one. Or if you have any support, you will give it with a positive way, do it.
That is Manal Taha, a Sudanese-born American scholar, speaking in Washington yesterday with Ayan Deng Bior. In the fourth and final part of our discussion with retired South Sudanese senior UN civil servant Peter Tingwa, the professor says the immediate task of a revitalized transitional government of national unity is to introduce nation building to students in all teaching institutions across South Sudan.
I hope the government that is going to come, the national government that is going to come, will have a big program of promoting unity practically. Through plays, through whatever means. You people in the media, to promote this unity, that we are all South Sudanese, we are the same, whether you are a Zande or a Dinka or something, you are the same. You know, I wish the government would put that program.
And the government would also give us the challenge that what are we doing to promote that? Because it takes two ways.
But it takes the responsibilities of the government. Nation building, yes, an individual does, but it is of the government to build the nation, to build the responsibility towards the nation. Its assets, it's something. It is the nation. Yeah, and individuals can, but it's the nation. If we have to put it in schools, the curriculum is prepared by this. The radio, which is the most important, also is controlled by the government.
You've been teaching throughout your life in the universities. If you are given an opportunity to assess the level and the quality of our learning institutions in South Sudan, what is your assessment?
I cry. My assessment is I cry, because I don't think that the standard of the universities is the same as in the past, although there are more facilities. I mean, more people are around now. Why? Because I think there is underfunding That is the main thing. Underfunding of the institutions of higher learning. When we were in the universities at that time, we had foreigners who came, who were paid by the government to come and be with us, you know, when we didn't have people. But now the government is, I don't know whether they can bring expatriates if there are no staff.
But why should they bring expatriates when we have Professor Peter Tingwa here?
Well, I'm retired. I cannot go back. There is a retirement age. Actually, I had already retired before but I could go and teach. We have a lot of educated people who could take up teaching in the universities, but the universities must be funded. That's my number one thing. They must be funded. Books, laboratories, libraries, and so forth.
You raise the point here that the one way of uniting the people and getting rid of tribalism is by educating people. Do you see any need for a curriculum that addresses these specific issues?
Yes, I do. But that should be in the primary. It should be right from the primary. You know, educating children about South Sudan, not my tribe, you see. Right from there, it should be programmed. Those who write the curriculum, you know what to do to promote being a South Sudanese over and above being my tribe, from my tribe, you see. So that is where the effort should be. You can't do it in the universities because those are grown already, and it's difficult. But it must be started from the beginning. I hope the Ministry of Culture or whatever and the Education are thinking along those lines. You know, many, even in America, you have been there. They raise the flag and children sing. All this is building nationalism and to supersede the tribal feelings. Because the tribal feelings is there. It's innate. Unless you work to overcome it, it will overcome everything.
That's Professor Peter Tingwa, a retired South Sudanese UN official, speaking to my colleague John Danza in Nairobi last week. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The results of the DRC election are announced. Find out the results and reaction when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what puts a smile on your face?
I have a group called Lishi. It's a group full of young children. So when I dance with them, it puts a smile on my face. Makes me happy.
What puts a smile on my face is good food and good people.
Okay, when I see good food and good friends around, well, I smile.
My husband really puts a smile on my face. He cracks jokes. He likes cracking jokes, and that makes me happy.
One thing that puts a smile on my face is to see somebody who has been in trouble or who has had great challenges, and then he has broken through. His life is better. Their lives have improved, their marriages, their business. It brings joy to my heart to see people becoming better.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo have sparked surprise and outrage by naming opposition candidate Felix Tshisekedi as the winner of the nation's presidential election. The man predicted to triumph, opposition coalition candidate Martin Fayulu, has cried foul, and analysts say they suspect Congolese citizens will feel similarly aggrieved. VOA's Anita Powell reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
At long last, after polls marred by delays and disorder, and after a 10-day wait for provisional results, Congo has a new president, the head of the Electoral Commission announced in the wee hours of Thursday.
President de la République démocratique du Congo, Monsieur Tshisekedi Tshilombo Félix.
Felix Tshisekedi is the provisional winner, Commission head Corneille Nangaa announced, who said that he had bested favorite Martin Fayulu by more than 500,000 votes. But that result came as a surprise. Pre-election surveys suggested Fayulu, a former oil executive and political newcomer, would triumph over a field that included President Joseph Kabila's preferred successor, former Interior Minister Emmanuel Shadary. Tshisekedi, a son of the former opposition leader, was a late entrant to the poll. Fayulu rejected the commission's announcement, calling it an electoral coup.
Considérant que cette attitude de la CENI suscite de suspicions légitimes.
This attitude from the Electoral Commission, he says, raises various legitimate suspicions that fuel political tension throughout the country. Tension has been part of this process since the start. The poll and the counting were rife with delays and problems. Voters couldn't find their names on the rolls. Election materials arrived late, and voting machines failed or were too complicated for voters. Provisional results were delayed, raising rumors and suspicions. A spokesman for Tshisekedi said his camp had been negotiating with Kabila, further sparking suspicions that the result was manipulated by the Electoral Commission, which is loyal to the outgoing president. Analyst Claude Kabemba says the real power is, and always has been, behind the scenes.
Oh, Joseph Kabila, we said directly or indirectly is going to stay in power. And I think we might have a prisoner in the presidency. And for me, that is scary. Unless I'm wrong, but judging from what has been happening behind the scene, and if Tshisekedi cannot rise to the occasion, he will be captured for a very long time.
Analyst Richard Moncrief of the International Crisis Group predicts Fayulu's supporters will not take the official outcome quietly.
There will be a lot of anger. That anger will spill over onto the streets, I'm quite sure. A lot of people, a lot of his supporters will agree that he won and will see a victory for Tshisekedi as a stolen result, so that's very dangerous.
Meanwhile, Congo's Catholic Church, which is active in the country's politics, said Thursday that the official results do not match the tallies compiled by the church's 40,000 election observers. Congo now holds its breath while Fayulu decides whether or not to legally contest the results. The Constitutional Court has 10 days to hear and rule on any challenges. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And on that point, a prominent church group in the DRC, the Catholic Bishops National Episcopal Conference of the Congo CENCO, told reporters at a news conference today that their election results show a different winner of the presidential election than the one announced by the Electoral Commission. Opposition leader Felix Tshisekedi was announced the winner last night, as we just heard, with 38.5% of the vote. The hand-picked candidate of President Joseph Kabila came in about 4.4 million votes, while Tshisekedi had supposedly 7 million votes over that. Our colleague Anastasi Tushteti covered the press conference and spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about what was said on the election results.
At the press conference, the CENCO said that the results published yesterday by the Electoral Commission, in extenso making Felix Tshisekedi the winner, did not match what they came up with, their counting of the vote. So there has been quite a movement in the room when they declared that. And also, we have learned that in three or four different places in Kinshasa, popular places, there have been fights between UDPS youth and Lamuka youth, the two being the main opposition party.
So who did they say would be, according to their tally, should be the winner?
Well, that's the thing. They didn't say anything. They said that that was not their role. Their role was to say that what was said was not the truth, but they would keep the name to themselves because they gave the numbers and the name to the CENI, and they refused to give the name because they think that that is not their role.
What are the other candidates saying about this?
Well, today is a press conference galore. There is a press conference with Lamuka in a few minutes. At the same time, there will be a press conference from the FCC, the majority party. And at 4:30, there will be a press conference with Etienne Felix Tshisekedi. UDPS will organize a press conference as well. Each of them will express themselves today.
Now, you mentioned earlier that there were fights that were breaking out among youths there. What are they fighting about?
They are fighting about their candidates and the fact that each camp is declaring that their candidate won.
So then what is going to happen? What is your expectation as time goes on?
It's very hard to say so far. But one thing is for sure, Martin Fayulu, who declared that, you know, he didn't recognize that Etienne Tshisekedi was the winner, has 48 hours to send a request to the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court has 8 days to decide whether or not Martin Fayulu's request is right.
That was Anastasie Tudeshi in Kinshasa speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis earlier. In rural Malawi, families send girls as young as 12 years old for initiation. That's a traditional cultural practice that marks a child's entry into adulthood. But child rights campaigners say the ritual entices young girls into early sex, marriage, and teenage pregnancy, forcing many to drop out of school. One local organization is seeking to change this by teaching initiation counselors to give girls age-appropriate information. Lamek Messina reports from Ulanji.
Madalitso Makosa was 13 years old when she underwent a traditional Malawian initiation ritual to become an adult. She says after the initiation ceremony, the counselors advised her to perform a kusasa fumbi or removing dust ritual with a man of my choice. She chose to sleep with her former boyfriend, but unfortunately, she became pregnant. Removing the dust refers to a girl losing her virginity, often without protection, to become an adult. Those who become teenage mothers pay the price for this tradition. Makosa says when she discovered she was pregnant, she was devastated because she had to drop out of school. She's now struggling to get support to take care of her baby. She wished she had continued with education. During the initiation, counselors show how they prepare girls for marriage and for sex. Agnes Matemba is an initiation counselor. She says she gives girls these lessons so that they should keep their man and prevent him from going out to look for another woman. Because if he goes out and finds excitement in other women, he is likely to dump her. Child rights campaigners say the initiation ritual fuels Malawi's high rate of child marriage. Half of the girls here marry before age 18. Malawian group YouthNet and Counseling, UNECO, wants to keep girls in school with a more age-appropriate initiation ritual. Mark Benning Kandawire is UNECO's executive director.
That's a traditional cultural thing that people believe in, and it would be very difficult to just say, let's end initiation ceremonies. But what we're saying is, can we package the curriculum in such a way that the young people are accessing the correct curriculum at the correct time?
UNECO is working with initiation counselors and traditional leaders to tone down Malawi's initiations. Already, some areas are banning the practice of encouraging sex after the ceremony. Aida Deliza is known as the senior chief Chikumbu.
We said, no. This is why we have a lot of dropouts from school. That's why we have the population has just shot so high, just because of that. Because a lot of girls now, they have got babies. Most of them, they are not in marriage.
To further discourage teenage pregnancy, traditional leaders like Chikumbu are dividing girls' initiation rituals into two camps. One is a simple ceremony for teenage girls like Makosa, while the other provides some sex education for older girls who are preparing to marry. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Mulanje.
That's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Eco by Fally Ipupa. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and we appreciate you tuning us in tonight. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. La merveille.